From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, playing the man who played Superman, we talk with Ben Affleck about his starring role as George Reeves in Hollywoodland. We'll also talk about growing up in Cambridge and being a child actor. Also, father and son jazz guitarist Bucky and John Pizzarelli compare styles. John has recorded many albums of jazz and pop standards. His new one is a tribute to Sinatra, and it features his father Bucky on guitar. Bucky played with Sinatra. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Ben Affleck. Earlier this month, he won the Best Actor Award at the Venice Film Festival for his starring role in the new movie Hollywoodland. He plays George Reeves, the actor who starred in the 1950s TV series Superman. As portrayed in the film, Reeves wanted fame, but he wanted it through movies, not through playing a superhero in a TV series for kids. We're going to talk about playing the man who played Superman, then we'll talk with Affleck about his life and some of his other roles. His other movies include Chasing Amy, Dogma, Shakespeare in Love, Pearl Harbor, Armageddon, and Good Will Hunting, which he co-wrote with Matt Damon. Let's start with a scene from Hollywoodland, just after Reeves has gotten a call from his agent. Reeves is describing the call to the woman he's having an affair with, who's the wife of an MGM executive. She's played by Diane Lane.
Art got a call. They're picking up Superman.
They're what?
Kellogg's. Bought it.
After 2 years?
That's right. I will be on television in a month. Wearing brown and gray underpants.
Well, hooray!
Christ.
Well, maybe it wasn't your proudest moment.
No, I'm quite sure it wasn't.
But you did create a very likable, very attractive, very heroic character.
Is that right?
I'd give it a second.
Well, one thing we can be sure of. No one with a lick of sense would watch that show.
Ben Affleck, welcome to Fresh Air. When you got the part of George Reeves and you went back and watched again old episodes of Superman, what things about his acting did you notice that you'd never noticed before? Things that you wanted to do too when you were portraying him?
Well, there were a number of things. You know, chief among them was that he had a real charm, and it was a kind of a kindness to him. And a kind of sweetness that I think is what kids responded to. And I don't think it's something that you can really fake, that he seemed to have a really good heart and that he enjoyed this idea and played with this kind of fundamental, central, underlying element of the show that made it, I think, really good at what it was that like, he was sharing this experience with kids, that he was sharing his secret with them and kind of, I mean, sometimes quite literally winking at the audience.
One of the things I think you capture about him as Superman is the way he'd kind of almost plant his feet on the floor, shoulders back, and almost like military style posture, and then put his like hands on his hips.
One of the nice things about the period is that there wasn't a lot of pretense, you know. Nowadays, we have a kind of, our heroes have to also be sort of slouching and conflicted.
Exactly.
And have the weight of the world on their head.
Right.
And this, there was no pretense to that. It was like he was Superman. He was proud and strong, and he had his hands on his hips, and he looked out into the middle distance because he was strong and he was going to protect people. It wasn't, this whole idea of like the hero now in movies and stories is, you know, doesn't want to have the curse of these powers, you know, and
yeah.
He had no such qualms. And even the kind of acting and the behavior style of the 1950s, if you kind of read further into it, there was kind of a presentationalism that was present in acting, which was a kind of self-conscious way of saying, I know I'm about to sit on this couch and smile at this woman, and I'm going to do so in a way that I hope is kind of endearing. You know, like Spencer Tracy, for example, did that really well, or Clark Gable. And I think that was present in social interactions too. Men wore hats and had kerchiefs in their pockets, and even if you didn't have any money, real working people tried to wear suits. It was an era of kind of trying to, you know, put on airs. wasn't a bad thing. It wasn't a put down. You know,
and there was even a more formal style of speaking in movies, no matter how informal the characters were supposed to be. And all of this is not your generation's style of acting. So, do you feel like you had to change your style of acting and not be conflicted and be more presentational?
Well, playing him in a way, I mean, obviously people still felt the same thing. So one of the things I thought was really interesting about this character was he was a guy who had the same conflicted feelings. In fact, I think George had a tremendous amount of sadness, maybe depression. Definitely he was an alcoholic, probably addicted to pain pills by the end of his life. And he was a very ambitious guy who suffered from the kind of thwarted ambition and the continuing humiliation that offered. So here's a tremendous amount of pain and difficulty, and yet he's living in a world that really where you have to kind of stiff upper lip and, you know, be gracious and still kind of be charming, because anything less than that is to admit a kind of unimaginable and terrible defeat. So I thought there was something really dramatically interesting. And on the one hand, having a guy who's full of agony and pain, but on the other hand, has to put on a good face.
But when you're playing him as an actor on the set acting,
right,
you have to
as
go
Superman,
into a different, as Superman, you have to go into a different acting style.
Absolutely. And one of the things I did to research that was really interesting is, rather than just watching him, I watched all his movies, I listened to all his stuff, I watched home videos, I talked to people who knew him, I went through the kind of, you know, the regular steps that you would take, obviously, researching somebody. But additionally, I thought, you know, here was a guy who was ambitious and kind of wanted to be other people, right? There's a line where he says he'd like to have Clark Gable's career. He is influenced in a way, not as much by who he actually is, but by who he wants to be. So I watched a lot of these movies at the time to see what were the things that he would be emulating. What were the styles that he would be trying to affect in his own performance? And so in effect, I tried to emulate those as he would have. And in doing, I think, ended up with that same kind of style, which, you know, was popular in the 50s, which was to speak really fast. You know, movies would be a lot shorter now if they had that 50s kind of clip of like, say, fella, what do you know? Nothing, chum. I don't know. Hey, back from the war? I sure am. Smoke camels. They're milder. It was like just, you know, very kind of repetitive, kind of zipping through your lines. And, you know, picking up on that and playing with that was really fun for me because it was so completely counter to the sort of ultra tape recorder realism, naturalistic style of our time.
What did it feel like to actually put on the famous tights and the famous cape?
It was daunting to a certain extent. We were really concerned with realism in the sense that we wanted to be really consistent with how they did it, particularly in that show, particularly when we were filming, you know, scenes that had to do with either him as Clark Kent or him as Superman, because everybody, you know, who watched the show obviously would have a pretty strong sense of what looked real and what didn't look real, what was, you know, jived with their memory and their sense of how it was, you know, done. And so one of the things I was able to do, there's a television kind of archive memorabilia people here, so have a museum, and I'm forgetting their name, which is a shame because I really appreciated what they did. But anyway, he came by, brought the actual suit that George wore and the rubber foam, you know, muscle suit underneath, and let me not only wear it, you know, not only touch it, but, you know, put it over my head and look at it. And that was a really kind of surreal moment where I was like sort of reaching out and touching the actual clothes that he wore, and you could see all these sweat stains and the thing, and you understood why it was so oppressive. He complained bitterly about it. And as he got more control, interestingly, later on in the series, there was much less of Superman and much more of Clark Kent. He would get these rashes and he would sweat, and, you know, he drank all day while he was doing the show because he was so miserable. And so then he would start to sweat the alcohol, which would like break down the foam rubber, and it was just a disaster. And the outside of the suit, you had this rubber that didn't breathe, and then the you know, tights, as it were, was basically just a wool sweater that was knitted, you know, with the S on it and everything else. And, you know, that combined with the fact that the film was so incredibly slow back then, it needed so much light to be dumped on to in order to be able to see, that, you know, they had these giant, incredibly hot lights. And also they hadn't figured out the technology of keeping lights cooler. So he literally roasted in this outfit. And I wanted to get a kind of a sense of that because everything I read about him, they talked about how incredibly oppressive this outfit was. And I thought that was kind of nicely and, you know, if not too obviously, representative of how onerous he found, you know, playing Superman, and the whole experience was kind of a burden on him.
The film isn't a comedy, but one of the funny lines in the movie is after he puts on his suit for a promotional appearance, he says, and before he walks out and meets his audience of children in this promotional appearance, he says to somebody after putting on the costume, "Is my penis showing?" And I thought, this is exactly the kind of thing that everybody always wondered if he thought about, you know? So is there any evidence he actually said that and wondered about it?
He was a very lively guy, and there's a lot of evidence that he thought about and joked about that kind of thing a fair bit. You know, a lot of times we look back at people in the 50s, and because their work is so, you know, had to fit into the constraints of the censors, and, you know, it was all kind of pretty chaste, that their actual personality somehow might have reflected that, which really isn't the case, I don't think. You know, and he was very, I don't know, ribald or whatever. He, you know, he'd make a lot of jokes about his penis and what could or couldn't be seen, and his, you know, taking his trousers off. And there's a scene in the movie where we do a bit where he actually kind of, what he would do quite regularly, which is kind of like break up on the set by pretending to, you know, like, something with Lois where he says, do you want to see the real Man of Steel? And he takes his pants off and he's sort of like pawing at her. And then, you know, Jimmy said, you know, says great, the chief comes in and says, great Caesar's ghost. And, you know, he says, more powerful than a locomotive. That, you know, he was the sexual innuendo and jokes like that, I think, did a lot to, and talking about how obviously foolishly revealing the outfit was, did a lot to kind of mitigate that embarrassment of feeling like a grown adult working on a television show. And as a way, kind of reminding themselves that they were adults, you know, trying to hold on to their dignity in some way, ironically.
You know, in George Reeves' case, he was typecast in that Superman role and couldn't break out of it. And, you know, a lot of people have drawn parallels to, like, your life in the sense, not that you were held hostage by a role, but by your private life for a period of time because of the whole Jennifer Lopez thing, the whole Bennifer thing. So are there ways in which that you identified with Reeves?
There are a number of ways in which I identify with Reeves. I guess there is a sense, kind of what you're alluding to, is there is a typecasting that happened then, which is about, you know, I can't watch George Reeves in this movie and take him seriously as Captain Stark because I just think of him as Superman. And I can't get that out of my head, and that's all I'm reminded of, so I have no ability to suspend disbelief and follow along with the story. I think there's the modern equivalent of that is similar but not the same, which is you can get typecast as yourself. In other words, audiences become so familiar with, particularly because of the proliferation of all these entertainment kind of media outlets, which is basically, you know, gussied up tabloids, whether in print or in electronic media, that, you know, because there's so many of them and there's this bigger audience, there's a bigger market, they run out of material, so they have to kind of create material, and then they really, you know, they overdo the sort of inane, like the truly pedestrian, to the point where, you know, you really know what, you know, some actor, maybe an actor you don't even like, or whose movies you haven't even seen, how, what they look like taking out the trash, and what their marital status is, and where their kids go to school, and what they look like in the morning before they've put their makeup on, or whatever it is. You get inundated with these images, whether you want to or not, almost, you know, on your AOL homepage, and every time you walk by a newsstand, and every time you turn on a television, you know, that it becomes hard to think of the person as a spaceman or as a, you know, as D.H. Lawrence or something. You just think that's not D.H. Lawrence. So that's the problem with that kind of typecasting. And I think because I was in a kind of high-profile relationship right around the time when media companies discovered that there was a bigger market for this entertainment pop culture stuff than they thought. And so everybody knew, as you say, that's this like a nickname for a relationship or, you know, details about a relationship that seem, it's just kind of, you can't believe other people know those sort of things about somebody else. It's like stuff I don't know about, you know, good friends of mine.
Yeah, well, the idea of being typecast as yourself so that people can't believe you playing a role is really interesting, and that certainly rings true. You know, in playing George Reeves in Hollywoodland, he's actually having an affair through the movie with the wife of an MGM studio executive. And the press basically doesn't cover that. And there's another studio executive whose job it is to make sure that stories like that don't get covered, you know, that the stars are protected. So did you think a lot about the difference between press coverage of movie stars then and now?
Yeah, I thought I yearned for those days. I couldn't. I thought, how wonderful would it be? How much better would my life have been? Career, everything, psychological well-being, if there was some, you know, velvet hammer enforcer guy who every time the press wanted to write something about, you know, ugly about someone's personal life, they just went around and broke their ankles. The idea is just so appealing.
My guest is Ben Affleck. He's starring in the new movie Hollywoodland. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Ben Affleck, and he plays George Reeves in the new movie Hollywoodland. Your new movie Hollywoodland, I think it's a really terrific film. I really enjoyed it.
Nice.
Before that, you were in a series of movies that didn't do so well. Recent films like Geely and Jersey Girl, Daredevil didn't do that well.
Daredevil did pretty well.
Did it do actually, well? Good. Sorry. Thank you for correcting
me. It's
okay.
I mean, it depends what you want to, you know, it depends how you define it. Again, it made $100 million. Is it my favorite
movie?
Well,
that sounds good.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Yeah. But is it hard to judge from a screenplay how good something's going to be?
Well, you raise an interesting point. It's kind of twofold. One is it depends on what your basis for evaluation is. You know what I mean? Like Pearl Harbor is a good example. Made a fortune. And a lot of people was like kind of pretty thoroughly pilloried. So it depends what's your goal there. Obviously, your goal is to make a good movie and ostensibly, you know, a return on the people who've invested their money in your movie. Because if they don't see that, you're not likely to continue to have people invest in you or your movies. So you have to serve two masters in that sense to a certain extent. Although, increasingly, I've come to believe that one kind of drives the other, quality drives the other, but not completely. I mean, it would be naive to say that. I think, you know, I like Jersey Girl. Geely was a movie that had nobler intentions and that got totally derailed and exploded by me being in a relationship with Jennifer Lopez. It didn't help that the movie didn't work. You know, and it's really hard. You don't really know. You know, it's a good example. I mean, Marty Brest directed one of my favorite movies in Midnight Run, and it was a really good script, and a lot of people wanted to be in that movie, and it was a coup for me to get the part. You know, it was a big deal. And then, you know, a movie doesn't end up working. You never know. It's a gamble.
Now, you know, you're playing somebody who played a superhero in the new movie Hollywoodland, and you played a superhero yourself, of course, in Daredevil. Did you grow up with a lot of, like, comic books? Because, like, there's Daredevil, which is based on a comic figure, of course, Superman. And in the movie Chasing Amy, you played a comic book artist. Does that have, like, personal connections for you?
Yeah, the reason that I did Daredevil, really, was because that was my favorite kind of comic book character growing up. And, you know, that was a kind of, I had a sort of mixed experience doing that movie. And ultimately, in some ways, that movie and doing it was sort of about how losing your, another way of saying, like, okay, I had these sort of feelings about this character as a child, and now seeing how I see it differently as an adult. One of the things it definitely did for me was give me an appreciation for George Reeves' dread of and feelings of absurdity about, you know, putting on a really cumbersome child's costume and pretending to go around and fight crime. You know, for one thing, you're acutely aware of the fact every time you put it on that it's kind of difficult just to walk across the room, much less go out there and corral bad guys. Additionally, it can kind of feel really humiliating. You know, you have it like half on, or you're just wearing the mask and you're shorts or whatever because it's so hot. And it just feels like, God, is this what I spent time, you know, like dreaming about as a kid and training for and trying to be an actor? So it was, you know, that wasn't the whole way I felt about Daredevil, obviously, but there were moments where I had those feelings, and that movie, if nothing else, was very good preparation for this movie.
Why did you start dreaming about acting as a kid?
Well, you know, I was that's a hard thing to say. I was a child actor. I, you know, I've definitely been, it's always something I felt like I had, I liked doing. I kind of guess I felt like I got some sense of self-esteem from it. I thought I was, you know, I would do sort of imitations or jokes even as a kid. I guess it's basically kind of, you know, precociousness, you know, in childhood. And then I sort of cultivated that, and, you know, I could kind of do voices and stuff. And then I would got into, at a young age, got sort of, because of whatever my personality or for some reason, I was asked to audition for something as a kid. I got that part. It was a PBS television series for children called Voyage and the Mimi. So then I did that from when I was about 9, you know, intermittently, from when I was 9 to about 13. And so then I started getting all this experience acting, and it was something that I felt I really liked doing, and I really felt like I was kind of good at. And I didn't feel like I was good at a lot else. So I got some, like I said, some self-esteem from it. And then I just started educating myself about all these actors out there and who they are and what their kind of art that they had to offer to the world was. And I just thought, like, this is who I want to be. I want to be somebody who can do this, and I want to learn how to do it better, and I want to kind of give myself over to that. So I've been trying to do that ever since.
What did you do as a child and young teenager to try to learn to act better?
I you know, I had a really great, and this is probably something you hear a lot, but I had a really great drama teacher, a guy named Jerry Specka in high school. And, you know, this was when I was 14. And he kind of taught that acting in some ways in theater and art were all looked at as part of life, not as a separate kind of a thing, and that lessons could be drawn from one into the other, and that you could look at them kind of all as part of the same whole. And by the same token, he also taught that kind of writing and acting were sort of part of, and directing were all part of the same discipline, which is kind of what empowered Matt Damon and I, who also had this teacher, to go ahead and kind of have the courage to write our own movie to act in, and that wasn't, you know, you didn't have to be, it didn't require some other additional, I don't know what, you know, credentials to do that, that we could have the courage to kind of do that and kind of improvise it. And it was very empowering for us.
Ben Affleck will be back in the second half of the show. He's starring in the new movie Hollywoodland. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available in stores and online at bn.com. And from the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, working to make cancer a national priority at Celebration on the Hill. Details at acscan.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Singer and guitarist John Pizzarelli has a new album paying tribute to Sinatra. It features his father, Bucky Pizzarelli, on guitar. Bucky played with Sinatra. Coming up, we talk with Bucky and John Pizzarelli, and we'll continue our conversation with Ben Affleck.
Life is dull, it's nothing but one big lull. Then presto, you do a skull and find that you're reeling. She sighs and you're feeling like a toy on a string. And your heart goes ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding. How could that funny face that seemed to be commonplace project you right into space without any warning? You don't know whether it's morning, nighttime, winter, or spring. What's the difference? Ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding. She grabs your hand, this captivating creature, and like it's planned, you're in the phone book, looking for the nearest preacher. Life is swell, you're off to that small hotel, and somewhere a village bell will sound in the steeple.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ben Affleck. He's starring in the new movie Hollywoodland. Affleck first became known for the 1997 film Good Will Hunting, which he co-wrote with his friend Matt Damon. They won an Oscar for the screenplay. When we left off, Affleck was telling us that a drama teacher that he and Damon studied with inspired them to write the screenplay. You mentioned, you know, working with Matt Damon, writing Good Will Hunting. When you wrote the film, I mean, he was the one who got the bigger part. Did you feel like you should have had an equally big part? Did that bother you?
I should have had a bigger part. No, well, part of it was very, you know, what we did with that movie was we were kind of, because all these independent movies have started to come out, like Do the Right Thing and Slacker and Dazed and Confused and, you know, Clerks, Reservoir Dogs. There was this growing awareness that kind of if you wanted to break in, you could kind of do it yourself and you could do it on the cheap, but you needed a few components. We knew that, you know, Quentin Tarantino somehow got Reservoir Dogs to Harvey Keitel. And because Harvey Keitel did it, you know, he was able to make his movie. And so when we wrote it, on one hand, we had this kind of creative side to what we wanted to do, which was we wanted to tell this story. And then in terms of storytelling, it was equally influenced by the pragmatic kind of how do we get our movie made side, where we knew, okay, you got to have a girl. We need to have a part, for a kind of very winning hero part for an actor that was, say, 50, because that was kind of the age that most of those, like, you know, your whoever it was, your De Niro's, your Pacino's, your, you know, obviously Robin was the top of our list, but your Robin Williams, those type of guys. So we said, okay, we need to have a part that will be appealing to one of those guys because they'll get to be great in the movie because we can't pay them any money. And we have to make it small enough that it doesn't take up much of their time. And all the scenes that they're in have to be about them. And then we have to have a girl and we have to have a lead. And then, you know, I was sort of like, I got to be the kind of Mercutio character, was sort of how we modeled it. Now, because you can't really have two leads in a movie in a way. And Matt, also, we needed, the idea was that someone had to let us do the movie. That, you know, people looked at us kind of like we were crazy. And I had historically had a few kind of supporting parts in movies. And then Matt had had two leading parts in movies, in School Ties and in Geronimo, the Walter Hill Western with Jason Patrick. So we felt like it would just be more palatable to people that, you know, we could get that past them. And then I would get to play a slightly more outrageous and ostensibly somewhat more kind of character-y and interesting part in playing the role of Chucky.
Well, you know, having co-written Good Will Hunting, is there anything from that movie that comes really directly from your life?
You know, there are a lot of different things. It's hard to say. You spent so much time with somebody. It's like a lot of stuff from my life, Matt's life. My father was a janitor at Harvard University. It wasn't MIT, but it was sort of similar. We definitely had a kind of town and gown relationship with Harvard kids. We grew up in Central Square in Cambridge, which was the sort of, at the time, it was the across-the-track side of Cambridge. I don't think there is an across-the-track side anymore. But, you know, so we had that kind of relationship that was, you know, we saw these kind of privileged, educated kids who, you know, came into the city and were somehow, you know, assumed to be either better than us or smarter than us and had that kind of resentment and something to prove. And so that bar scene where, you know, Will confronts that sort of pompous, preppy kid from Harvard and does so by sort of an intellectual duel, you know, winning the duel, was kind of a fantasy wish fulfillment thing for us as, like, you know, kids from that city. You know, and then there's a lot of, you know, smaller details. The Sean character, the Robin Williams character, is in a lot of ways based on, you know, our drama teacher that we talked about in terms of as a mentor, kind of father figure. And there were a lot of stuff that was, you know, was a little bit more too personal to kind of get into. But I don't think you can do anything that you really care about with having, without having some of your, you know, personal life and history bleed into it.
You have a movie that you directed that's coming out in 2007, I think?
It'll be out about a year. My hope is either year from either now or a year, or it'll be out next spring, one or the other.
So, and is it based on a Dennis Lehane novel?
Yes, it's based on a Dennis Lehane novel called Gone Baby Gone, which was his first novel. His first five books were a series of detective books with these two detectives, Angie Gennaro and Patrick Kenzie, who sort of went who in Boston and you know went through and kind of handled these various cases and such. And this is actually the fourth book in that series, and it's kind of a sort of crime, morality, drama, sort of morally ambiguous story about children in a really scary, unpleasant world. And it's, you know, I got a great cast, and we just finished shooting in Boston, which was terrific. And I'll be editing and trying to put the movie together, you know, for the next 6 months or so.
Your brother Casey Affleck's in your film. What was it like to direct your brother?
It was really interesting. You know, it was kind of it's hard because you have to put on a different hat. You know what I mean? You can't have this conversation with your brother the way you'd have it with your brother if he's an actor in your movie. You have to treat him as you would treat an actor in the movie, which sometimes means, I mean, something as simple as trying to swallow the urge to strangle him, you know, or to be really curt with, like, just because I said to do it that way, that's why, you know, instead of going like, well, okay, that's interesting. I hear you. Let's process what you're talking about. So it was an exercise in self-discipline. But, you know, my brother, the thing that's really rewarding is that he's a really, really good actor, and he's typically been seen in, you know, kind of character roles as well. So I think, you know, I have the good fortune of being able to show an audience something kind of new and surprising that's also really good. And that's a rarity.
It's lucky you had faith in him and didn't have to make up an excuse about why you were not going to cast him in your movie.
Exactly. You're just not that right for it. I don't know. No, I'm casting another 30-year-old Caucasian 5'10 man, but he has brown eyes.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Ben Affleck is starring in the new movie Hollywoodland. Earlier this month at the Venice Film Festival, he won the Best Actor Award for his performance in the film. Singer and guitarist John Pizzarelli has a new album paying tribute to Sinatra. It features his father, Bucky Pizzarelli, on guitar. Coming up, we meet them both. This is Fresh Air. Guitarist and singer John Pizzarelli has recorded many albums of great jazz and pop standards. One of the reasons I like Pizzarelli is his relaxed sense of rhythm. It seems to come naturally to him, perhaps because he's the son of the great guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli and started playing with him as a boy. Bucky played with some of the top performers of his time like Sinatra, Tony Bennett, Peggy Lee, and Rosemary Clooney. Bucky plays guitar on John's new album, Dear Mr. Sinatra, which features songs recorded by Sinatra.
I thought I found the girl of my dreams. Now it seems this is how the story ends. She's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends? I thought for once it couldn't go wrong. Not for long. I can't see the way this ends. She's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends? Why should I care though she gave me? Why should I cry, heave a sigh, and wonder why, and wonder why?
The songs on Dear Mr. Sinatra include You Make Me Feel So Young, I've Got You Under My Skin, and How About You? John Pizzarelli chose this song, Can't We Be Friends, as an homage to the late guitarist George Van Epps, who played on Sinatra's recording. On John's version, his father Bucky takes the solo. That's from John Pizzarelli's new CD, Dear Mr. Sinatra, and we heard John singing and Bucky Pizzarelli, his father, featured on guitar. Welcome, both of you, back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Nice
Thank
to be here.
John, on the liner notes of your new CD, you thank your father for the best thump in the business. What do you mean by that?
Well, the thump you hear throughout the record is just the way he plays rhythm guitar. I think that the sound of his guitar is the heartbeat of the whole band. You know, Jeff Hamilton will tell you too how great that sound of that is as a drummer. To hear that rhythm guitar sound is it's really thrilling to me, actually, and I just love the sound of it. And a lot of people call it a chunk, but I call it a thump because it's more of a heartbeat to me than it is anything else, so I call it a thump. I love his thump.
But John, you play rhythm guitar yourself, so why do you prefer on this album, for instance, to have your father playing the rhythm?
Because he's better than me. So if you have somebody who's better than you at rhythm guitar, it's always good especially if he's related, because he'll work for scale. But in this case, that's really the reason. I mean, he's the best doing what he does. So I figured I always try to hire the best musicians, and I can play rhythm guitar, but not like him. So it was, and it's easier for him to do it because he's not singing.
Bucky, did you ever sing?
No, I wish I could.
It made more money, right? Over.
Bucky, when John was a boy, did you think at some point that one day you'd be playing on his records in addition to him playing on yours?
No, I never thought of that. He had a little band, and every time the band rehearsed in the garage, the cops would show up, and it was so loud.
Seriously?
I'm not kidding.
Wait, this must have been rock and not jazz?
Well, he had so many amplifiers, I couldn't park the car.
They were all in the garage.
So, John, what were you playing in the garage when the police were coming?
Well, I was playing, our band just played songs that we could play that had three or four chords. So we played the Allman Brothers, we played some Eric Clapton, and mostly Peter Frampton. I liked him and the Eagles and James Taylor and Jackson Browne and those kind of bands. And we liked to play outside in the summer, and that's what got us in a lot of trouble, from playing outside.
So what got you from there back into the kind of jazz that your father had played?
Well, he never said any of that was bad. He just didn't like the volume. So, you know, that was the thing. We loved music so much. And then he had said in an interview once years ago, and I didn't even realize it, is that I had learned Chick Corea's Spain off of a record to play with a bunch of our friends at a talent show. This kid wanted to play it on the trombone, so we all learned it. And he was impressed that I learned this difficult song off the record, because that's how I learned songs, rock songs. And so that's when the Django Reinhardt lesson came up. You know, I learned the Rose Room off of a Django Reinhardt record, and then I learned some of the duets that he did with George Barnes off of the record. So I got to do gigs with him, and then I would do my rock and roll gigs. He said I was the only jazz musician who played jazz to support his rock and roll habit. It's usually the other way around.
Bucky, when John was a boy, did you intentionally try to do things to expose him to music and to the music that you particularly loved? You probably heard a lot of it just in the course of things, but, you know, like some people will actually, like, make sure that they're playing certain records to their children when their children are around, so that...
No. Yeah. You know, actually, we had a lot of people come over to the house, like Joe Venuti and Zoot Sims. Benny Goodman was over many times. Mm-hmm. And when they saw these big figures, you know, I think it made a big impression, especially Zoot.
Yeah, they were like stars, you know. So that was that was the thing, too. If you really wanted to speak my father's language, you had to learn his songs. You know, you had to learn Honeysuckle Rose and Sweet Georgia Brown and Rose Room, because that way you could get in on the jam session, you know. Otherwise, you were sort of outside the circle.
Bucky, were there things you didn't want to expose John to about your musician friends? No. Did they have any, like, bad habits or crude language that you didn't want to expose your son to?
No, I mean, they heard that in high school anyway, so.
It was probably worse in high school. You know, everybody was gentlemanly around the house. Zoot Sims was one of the greatest guys to hang around. He liked to play ping pong. We'd play ping pong with him, and he was drinking scotch the whole time, but we never thought anything about him drinking scotch, you know, and hanging out all day with us.
Slam store and had Ovaltine every night.
Yeah, that was everybody was fun.
John, how old were you when you started playing with your father?
I guess it had to be 16, 17, 18, somewhere in there is when I would come on at the end of gigs that he would do his solo concerts and play either Chicken a la Swing and Stage Fright or Honeysuckle Rose. Those were like the three things that I knew. So it was probably 1976, 77, 78.
How did you both feel about that? John, how did you feel about playing with your father?
Oh, I always loved it. That was fun for me to go to the gigs. I loved hearing him play, and whoever he was playing with was fun. So I loved going with him to record dates when I was a little kid. I could sit in the studio all day and listen to him play. So there was something in me that it was much like my father, the stories I've heard about him as a youngster playing the guitar. So I was just meant to be a musician. It's a good thing he wasn't a plumber, or else we wouldn't be on the air today.
And Bucky, what was it like for you to bring your son on stage? Were you convinced he was really talented at this point, or did it just feel like, okay, well, I'm going to give my son a little showcase. Because, you know, a lot of parents just want to show
off
their children.
Well, he had the passion. I know. He had the passion to want to play. I knew that. So I didn't want to stop him from doing anything. You know, and then if I brought him up on stage, I knew what he was going to play. So it worked out.
Well, John, your new CD is songs associated with Frank Sinatra. But I want to go back to an earlier CD of duets between the two of you. And this is an album called Contrasts. That was released back in 1998. And I thought we'd play Stage Fright, which is a composition that was originally recorded as a duet by the guitarist Carl Kress and Dick McDonough. So how did you start working this up together as a duet?
Well, that was a part of the repertoire in the Pizzarelli family. I learned from my uncles, and they told me, listen to Dick McDonough and Carl Kress, and listen to George Van Epps and Alan Roos. And
you had the original records of Carl and Dick playing Stage Fright.
Yeah, the old 78s, so we listened to them, and then we found the music somehow, and all of a sudden we started playing it.
Yeah, he had like a third-generation photocopy of Stage Fright and Chicken All Swing, and he originally, it is part of the Pizzarelli repertoire. My sister Mary originally played the parts, the second parts that I play on this recording. And then he would sit down and say, here's what you got to do. And we'd learn, we'd do 8 bars at a time. And I'd get hit over the head a couple of times. But by the end, we have it all worked out. But this is really like one of the first things that we played together.
Okay, well, this is Bucky Pizzarelli and John Pizzarelli, father and son, from a 1998 album called Contrasts. That's Stage Fright, featuring my guests Bucky and John Pizzarelli from their 1998 album Contrasts. John's new album, featuring his father, is a tribute to Sinatra. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are singer and guitarist John Pizzarelli and his father, the guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli. Bucky plays guitar on John's new album, Dear Mr. Sinatra. How would you each describe your guitar styles? How would you compare them? Bucky, how would you compare your style and John's?
I started back in the 30s when I was taking a lesson from my uncles, Peter and Bobby Dominic. And Bobby was on the road with a lot of dance bands, Clyde McCoy, Buddy Rogers, Frank Daly. And every time he came off the road, you know, during Depression, he had a little Dodge. He had a gabardine suit on and a big, beautiful Gibson guitar. And boy, my eyes opened up. And the next thing, he'd show me a few chords that nobody in Patterson ever saw. That's what got me started. So I just followed his career, and I said, when I get up, when I get older, I'd like to do the same thing. And luckily, when I was 17, I got out of high school, and I went with Vaughn Monroe's band, only to be drafted in about 4 months later. But I did get a taste of it when I was a kid.
So you're a product of the big bands.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything was a big band setting for me.
John, how would you compare your style to your father's?
Well, I think he was, like he said, he's sort of more of a product of guys all playing together and learning from my father, his uncles. I learned more off of records and then from playing with my father. We have these 7-string guitars with the low A. It's a regular guitar with a low A on it that George Van Epps had invented, and we got the guitars and learned that, and we could accompany each other because we had the bass notes. And I think that my guitar style is a little coarser, got a little more point to it. I think he's more of a chord melody, and there's more of a real sensitive style to the way he plays. You know, it's funny though, is that he came to a gig that we did once, and he played my guitar. I called him up to play my guitar and play a couple of solos on it. And when he played my guitar, which is a different brand and just different everything, and he played my guitar and he sounded like him on his guitar. So I was like, well, that's obviously not the guitar. It's something inside his hands that's where his sound comes from. So it's two different sounds. His is, I think, probably more studied and there's something about his style that captures every guitar player who listens to him, and mine is just different.
John, when did you start singing?
I sang through all the way. You know, I like to sing Beatles songs and all that all the way from the beginning. But it was when I went to college, I would play in coffee houses James Taylor and Kenny Rankin and Michael Frank songs, and when I came back from school in 1980. I accompanied my high school buddy who sang like Dick Haymes and Sinatra and Crosby songs. And I would accompany him. We'd play in restaurants and things. And when he'd say, you sing a song, I'd play, Popsicle Toes or some Michael Franks tune. And that's when I found all the Nat King Cole songs. So I would sing roots. You know, when I found those songs, I really found a repertoire that I could build the foundation for who I wanted to be on. So it was really around that time that I started to do that. And then we'd play concerts together, and my dad, in the middle of the concert, he'd say, sing Route 66 or something, you know. He'd point to me, and I'd sing Route 66 and Sentimental Reasons. We'd always do that in the middle of our shows.
Well, I have to say, you guys obviously really enjoy playing with family because you've not only played a lot with each other, and then there's your uncles, but also, John, you and your wife, Jessica Mulaski, perform a lot together. What's special about performing with family? Oh, I should mention your brother, Martin, the bass player, who's in your trio.
That's right.
Yeah. So what's special about playing with family?
Well, my father has an expression. You know your expression? You can't beat blood. He just loves... There's something about... That's special about it that I've always loved. We love playing music in the house. We don't think of music as a profession, I don't think. We just love playing. And there's an idea that when I met Jessica, too, she had the same kind of idea about performing that we did. There's just something wonderful about being able to play music for people. And we got it from our uncles. They love just playing the banjos out and wherever people wanted to hear them. And it wasn't really about making money. And that's what we sort of learned at. I mean, why we like playing together as a family, I guess. It's easier. And you don't have to pay everybody as much.
Everybody was out of work.
Well, John Pizzarelli, Bucky Pizzarelli, thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Terry. Good to talk to you again, Terry.
John Pizzarelli's new album, Dear Mr. Sinatra, features his father, Bucky Pizzarelli, on guitar. This week, John's group, The Swing Seven, performs at Birdland in New York. Here's Nice and Easy from John's new CD.
Let's take it nice and easy. It's gonna be so easy for us to fall in love. your hurry. Relax and don't you worry. We're gonna fall in love. We're on the road to romance, that's safe to say. But let's make all the stops along the way. The problem now, of course, is to simply hold your horses. To rush would be a crime. 'Cause nice and easy does it every time.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Tequila, an instrumental that was a number one hit in 1958. Danny Flores, the saxophonist on the record, who also shouted Tequila, died last week at the age of 77.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Social Intelligence, The New Science of Human Relationships by Daniel Goleman, author of Emotional Intelligence. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from Rosalind Croman Swig, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Ian Buruma about his new book, Murder in Amsterdam. It's about the murder of filmmaker Theo van Gogh by a young Muslim who thought van Gogh's work insulted the Prophet Muhammad. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.